Welcome to the Higher Education Policy and Finance Division remote hearing, held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. I'm Representative Connie Bernardi, the chair of the committee. Committee staff will be muting and unmuting as we go. This will be announced throughout the hearing. We have consulted with Representative Dornis and our research team, and we will be conducting most votes by voice vote unless a roll call has been requested, with the exception of the final vote of the day, which will be a roll call. We must stick to the time allotted for this hearing, so we will be adjourning at 4 p.m. Testifiers and members, please be mindful of the time. We will start with taking attendance so we know who is on the call. Staff will unmute the lines. The clerk will now take the roll.
Chair Bernardi?
Present.
Vice Chair Pryor?
Present.
Representative Nornis?
Present.
Representative Daniels?
Present.
Representative Franson?
Present.
Representative Gomez?
Present.
Representative Cleavorn?
Present.
Representative Lehman?
Present.
Representative Lean?
Present.
Representative Lilly?
Present.
Representative Lucero?
Fantastic.
Representative Poppy?
Present.
Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Runbeck?
Here.
Representative Vang?
Present.
Representative Wogamot?
Present.
Representative Zhang?
Present.
Madam Chair, the roll is complete and there is a quorum is present. I will now lock the call.
A quorum is present. Staff will now mute the line. Also present on the call are committee staff.
You have been muted. To unmute yourself, press the star key twice. Mute off.
Okay, I keep getting a mute on and off, so we'll try that again. A quorum is present. Staff will now mute the lines. Also present on the call are committee staff, Sean Williams, House Research, Ken Savory, House Fiscal, Bennett Smith, DFL Research, Callie Lehman, GOP Research, Addie Miller, Committee Administrator, Eric Peterson, Committee Legislative Assistant. We have testifiers on the line as well. Public notice was given, and members of the public who wish to testify have contacted staff and are on this call. Paul Cervenek from the Minnesota Private College Council, Commissioner Dennis Olson, and Nikki Oliver, as well as Betsy Talbot, all from the Office of Higher Education. Members, as we proceed, if you have any questions or wish to be recognized, please email or text the committee administrator. The first order of business is to approve the minutes from our last remote meeting on April 28, 2020. Staff will unmute Representative Vang to make the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the minutes from April 28, 2020 to be approved.
The committee administrator will now announce any members who wish to be recognized for discussion of the minutes.
Madam Chair, there are no requests.
Representative Vang moves the minutes for April 28, 2020. Staff will unmute the line. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion carries and the minutes are approved. Staff will now mute the line. Members, the first two bills on the agenda were already given a full hearing and laid over earlier this year in the hopes that they would be able to have an omnibus bill at the end of session. Given the current circumstances, there will not be an omnibus bill, and therefore we must move these two bills to Ways and Means. First is House File 3089, carried by Representative Cagle, having to do with Addiction Medicine Fellowship. We heard this bill on February 19th and laid it over. Staff will unmute Representative Lilly to make this motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Lilly, would you like to move House File 3089 be referred to Ways and Means?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly moves House File 3089 to be referred to Ways and Means. We can now take questions. Will staff please announce the first member wishing to be recognized?
Madam Chair, I do not have any requests.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Miller. We will then move on to our motion. And our motion, Representative Lilly moves House File 3089 to be referred to Ways and Means. Staff will unmute the lines. We can handle this by voice vote. If someone would like a roll call, please announce yourself and request one now. A roll call has been requested. No, excuse me, it has not been requested. Excuse me. We will do this by a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion carries, and House File 3089 is on its way to Ways and Means. Staff will mute the line. Next is House File 3232, carried by Representative Pawlowski, regarding career and technical education pilot programs. We heard this bill on March 11th and laid it over. Staff will unmute Representative Poppy to make the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 3232 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Poppy moves House File 3232 to be referred to Ways and Means. We can now take questions. Will staff please announce the first member wishing to be recognized?
Madam Chair, there are no requests.
Okay. Representative Poppy moves House File 3232 to be referred to Ways and Means. Staff will unmute the lines. We can handle this by a voice vote. If someone would like a roll call, please announce yourself and request one now. We do not have a roll call, so all those, and we'll do it by a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
The motion carries, and House File 3232 is on its way to Ways and Means. Staff will mute the lines. Last on the agenda, we'll be taking up Office of Higher Education's agency bills, House File 3992, and the amendment that includes language from House File 4553. Nonpartisan staff suggested we take up the two bills together to ensure both bills align within the same statutory appropriately. The same statute appropriately. I'd now like to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Pryor. Staff will now unmute her line.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Would you like to move your bill?
I move the DE2 amendment. And I will also move, excuse me, first I will move House File 3992 be referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Vice Chair Pryor. Chair Bernardi,
Madam Chair,
House File.
Just to correct that House File number, I'm sorry, this is Addie. Madam Chair, members, that House File number, I'm sorry, is 3392 instead of 3992.
Great. Thank you very much for that question. I mean, for that clarification. All right, Chair Bernardi, then you move House File 3992 be referred to Ways and Means.
Well, actually, it's House File, excuse me, Vice Chair Pryor, there has been a correction to the House File, and I want to make sure that it is House File 3392, and I be referred to Ways and Means, and I would like to defer to our committee administrator to be sure that correction is accurate.
Madam Chair and members, yes, that is 3392. That is correct.
Okay. All right. So, and we might need this correction later on, too, if I do misstate it. So Chair Bernardi moves House File 3392 be referred to Ways and Means. And there's also an author's amendment labeled DE2. Chair Bernardi, would you like to move the DE2 amendment and get the bill in its proper form before we walk through it?
Yes, I would. I move the DE2 amendment.
Chair Bernardi moves the DE2 amendment. Staff, please unmute the lines. We can do this by voice vote. If someone would like a roll call, please announce yourself and request one now.
Madam Chair, this is Addie.
Yes.
There is a question. There's a request for a question. From Representative
Daniels. Representative, please unmute Representative Daniels' line, and please state your question, Representative Daniels.
Yes, thank you. I'm just wondering, would it be a good time to have a discussion about this bill? Are we coming up to that point, or are we past that point?
Yes. Thank you, Representative Daniels. The process that we're starting on right now is to, first of all, just get the bill in front of us, and that includes the amendment that we'll be adding to it right now, and then we'll do a walkthrough of the bill, and then we'll have questions and discussions.
Sounds good. Put my name for the questions after we're done with that, then, please.
Yeah, and then, again, you'll be recognized for questions. Thank you, Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair.
And right now, then, we have the amendment, and this is just to get the bill in the order that the author would like. And we will do this, not hearing a request for a roll call. We will again do this by voice vote. And staff will now unmute the line. All right. If lines are unmuted, all those in favor of adopting the amendment, the DE2 amendment, in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Are those any opposed? The motion carries and the amendment is adopted. And staff will now mute the lines. Chair Bernardi,
members,
to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair Pryor. Members, this bill with the DE2 amendment now adopted includes language from House File 3392, we heard on February 19th, and the language from House File 4553, which we heard on April 15th. The amended bill is the result of extensive collaboration with the Office of Higher Education. It includes the school closure language, protecting Minnesota students from a repeat of the Argosy situation, and amends the language into the non-controversial provisions in the Office of Higher Education's policy bill. At this time, I'd ask Sean Williams from House Research to be recognized to walk us briefly through the bill.
Staff will now unmute Sean Williams' line. Yes. And Mr. Williams, please walk us through the amendment.
Chair Pryor and members, just want to confirm that you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
Very good. So I'm going to go through the amendment. I'm going to try and stay at a fairly high level and focus on things that have changed from the underlying bill, House File 3392, as it was heard earlier in this year in committee, because that bill has been already heard once. So starting with Section 1 of Article 1, that language establishes a statewide concurrent enrollment evaluation survey. It's something that would be administered jointly between the Minnesota Department of Education and the Office of Higher Education. The specific demographic outcomes and data that would be included in that evaluation would be determined with stakeholders by the two agencies. And that language, I believe, is to replace some different language related to concurrent enrollment data that was in the bill as introduced. Section 2 of the bill creates a definition of an incident of sexual assault. That language is the same as it was in House File 3392 that we heard earlier this session. Section 3 just allows the Office of Higher Education to be known as the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. That was not unchanged from the previous version. Section 4 relates to the Student Advisory Council. This language is very similar to what was included in House File 3392, but the language essentially allows the representative from private career schools to be elected by students enrolled in private career schools, and also allows a student in a Minnesota tribal college to be elected by students enrolled in Minnesota tribal colleges. The new language also says that if the private career schools or tribal colleges do not elect a representative themselves, the commissioner may appoint one. Section 5 of the bill establishes a Tribal Nations Education Committee. This is a committee that the Commissioner of Higher Education would be tasked with consulting with on matters related to American Indian students. The language is largely the same as it was introduced in House File 3392 with some minor technical changes. Section 6 of the bill establishes a FAFSA completion goal for the state of Minnesota. That language is the same as it was in House File 3392. Section 7 amends the eligibility requirements for state financial aid programs. This language came from House File 4553, that's the school closure bill. It amends their requirements and imposes some new requirements on schools that receive state financial aid. They have to comply with the surety bond requirements that are established later in the bill. They can lose financial aid eligibility if they don't make progress towards Pell Grant eligibility or lose Pell Grant eligibility. They can lose financial aid eligibility if they violate administrative policies or laws regarding financial aid programs. They can lose it if there's a consistent pattern of noncompliance with the laws and administrative policies, or if the office determines that they lack the administrative capacity to administer financial aid programs. So Section 8 of the bill, that's a termination procedure that just requires the Office of Higher Education to notify a school that's going to be terminated from financial aid programs, and it's effective 90 days after the date of the written notice. That language is from House File 4553. Section 9 also allows a school whose eligibility for financial aid programs is terminated to request a hearing under Chapter 14, which is the State Administrative Procedures Act. That language was also in 4553. Section 10 is a prohibition. A school can't withdraw a student from enrolling or attending classes due to an unpaid balance with the school unless the student is allowed a refund. The language is similar to what was in House File 3392, except there's a clarification of what a period of instruction means in this new language. Section 11 of the bill allows schools that offer primarily or only graduate degrees to participate in the child care grant program. That language was identical as what was in 3392. Section 12 updates a reference to the Department of Education, Minnesota Professional Educator Licensing and Standard Board, licensure board that was established a couple of years ago. That language has technical changes from the original bill, but was included in 3392. Section 13 of the bill allows the Office of Higher Education to determine limits on the amount of loans made through the self-loan program. That's unchanged from the original bill, 3392. Sections 14 and 15 are amending existing law to reference Educator Licensing and Standards Board instead of the Department of Education. Section 16 lifts the five-recipient cap for the large animal veterinarian loan forgiveness program. That language is identical with what was in House File 3392. Section 17 requires degree-granting schools to share compliance audits and audited financial statements that are required under federal law, as well as additional information that the Office of Higher Education needs to calculate non-financial risk measures. That language was in House File 4553. Section 18 is the additional surety requirements language that was also in House File 4553. Current law requires schools that may be at risk of closure or have low financial or don't meet minimum federal financial standards to provide a surety bond of $10,000 to $250,000. The bill increases that surety bond amount to 10% of net revenue from tuition and fees. And it also creates a list of priorities for the use of that bond. Those priorities are available in the bill summary on page 5, if you want to look through what the priorities would be. Section 19 essentially establishes the criteria for a school being a degree or a name approval from the Office of Higher Education. A school has to establish a student complaint process or a financial risk analysis. This is largely the same as what was in 3392 and 4553, but language related to pre-dispute arbitration clauses has been removed. Section 20 is language that was in 3392 that limits conditional approval for schools that are physically located in Minnesota. Section 21 allows the Office of Higher Education to revoke or suspend a school's registration under certain circumstances, including having fraudulent practices, demonstrating incompetence, financial irresponsibility. If there's no enrollment within 2 years of registering with the university or within the last 2 years, or if the school does not provide a surety bond, it additionally gives the Office of Higher Education some authorities if a school fails to meet, take part in the risk analysis that's required in the bill. So the Office of Higher Education could potentially withhold aid payments, oversee the transfer of aid payments to students, require the return of advance aid payments, or requirement documentation that aid was properly used. Section 23 of the bill it allows schools to apply for a religious exemption for registration requirements for some programs only rather than just for if only some of the programs, schools' programs are not religious. Section 24 of the bill stipulates that there's no religious exemption from registration requirements if schools engage in false or deceptive marketing practices, and those provisions were in underlying bills, House File 3392. Section 25 is a technical change to correct the cross-reference. That was in House File 3392. Section 26, that's the language from House File 4553 related to the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, or SARA schools. Just allows the Office of Higher Education to collect fees of either $750, $3,000, or $7,500, depending on the enrollment of the university, for the cost of participating in SARA. Section 27 is the risk analysis section that was from House File 4553. That allows requires schools to participate in a risk analysis process with the Office of Higher Education to determine if the school is at risk of a precipitous closure. And it also requires institutions to notify the Office of Higher Education based on certain indicators of financial instability. Section 28 increases the registration fees for schools depending on the types of degrees they offer. And Section 29 and 31 allow the office to charge back to universities consultant fees used for investigation of those schools. The two different sections are for degree granting and private career schools. Section 30 and 32 relate to student complaints, and it essentially allows the office to charge back to schools a fee if they receive Section 33 stipulates that no notice that a student is withdrawing from classes does not need to be in writing. There's new language in there indicating that the school also must confirm to the students in writing that they received the notice of withdrawal. Section 34 allows the Office of Higher Education to revoke or suspend the license of private career schools if they use fraudulent, coercive, dishonest practices or demonstrate incompetence, untrustworthiness, or financial irresponsibility. That's the same as it was in 3392. Section 35 is another religious exemption related to false or untruthful or advertising. This is the version for private career schools of the same policy I described earlier. Section 36 is the one that allows the school to receive a religious exemption for some of its programs and allow others to be subject to Section 37 is more language related to false or deceptive marketing practices by schools that have a religious exemption. And that concludes Article 1. So I'd pause here and ask if any members have any questions about that article.
Our committee administrator, do we have any questions from members? Ms. Miller?
Madam Chair, we have three members who have requested. The first is Representative Daniels.
Representative Daniels, please proceed with your question.
Well, thank you. Some of this would be kind of a general statement, but even when we read that bill the first time, I just read it. A lot of it is pretty far overreaching, maybe even like a little bit of overkill on that. And we were talking to some of the private colleges and had a little discussion. And have you talked to any private colleges, Chair Bernardi, as far as if how they are with this language? Because there's quite a few penalties if they're, you know, paybacks for the students and the $100,000 bond. What kind of feedback have you had from the private colleges?
Okay, well, thank you for that, Madam Vice Chair. Chair Bernardi. Yeah, thank you. We have talked with the non-profit private colleges about this, and they have weighed in on things that they like and don't like about it. The Office of Higher Education's responsibility is oversight of our higher education institutions, and they, a lot of this language has been worked together on since last fall. And the language, and some of the language, and I'll have to verify this probably with the Office of Higher Ed. I'm going through my notes here. But some of this language was recommended by the private colleges as well, and they were involved in it. Now, whenever anybody does do oversight, people don't necessarily, are enthusiastic about having that oversight. But they have been involved and continue to be involved, and we're continuing to listen to their concerns. In the end, we probably won't have a bill that's written by the people that are that we're overseeing, but definitely a lot of input and stakeholder involvement has happened, and we are trying to, we continue to work with them, and we want to get this strong bill passed through the session this year. Hope that answers your question.
Yes, thank you, Representative Daniel. And then what I'll do is, I've got some questions, but I'll wait until staff gets through Article 2.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Conference unlocked.
So at this point, we're through just the first article, and we do have a testifier from the Minnesota Private College. Does anybody have any, just a clarifying question that would be addressed to Mr. Williams at this point? Because we can have a discussion of the whole bill after the walkthrough is done. And Ms. Miller, can you maybe announce the other questions that we have at this point, and we can unmute them, and we can see if their questions would be better served at the end.
Madam Chair, that's a great idea. Representative Dornis and Representative Runbeck are still on deck.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Miller. Yes, Representative Dornis, is this a question that we should save at the end for our discussion, or is it a clarifying question for Mr. Miller? Mr. Williams,
that was my intent to wait till all the testimony has been presented, and then before we vote on the bill, that's where I'd like to have some time.
Thank you, Representative Dornis. And Representative Runbeck, is your question better at this point or would at the end after our walkthrough and our completed testimony?
I'm happy to wait till the end. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Williams, please proceed.
Chair Pryor and members, I'll discuss now Article 2. The substance of this language has not changed significantly since we last heard it, although there have been a few changes. And I don't think it's necessarily helpful to go through this section by section, but I am happy to discuss some of the specific sections or changes if members have questions. Article 2 makes changes just to the state's law that governs the state's Section 529 College Savings Plan, the Minnesota College Savings Plan. Most of these changes are responding to updates in federal law. Some of the updates allowing rollover account, contributions for ABLE accounts, allowing recontributions to 529 accounts, and then changes to the definitions of what counts as qualifying higher education expenses. I would say that some of the the definition of qualifying higher education expenses that was in the bill that we heard previously has been removed, so there's no explicit reference to that in the current language. And then there's also language that has changed the purposes for which the state matching grants can be used. So just for some background for committee members, the state previously operated a matching grant program, College Savings Plan, that was discontinued the matching grant program, however, there are still some accounts that receive matching grants, and there's some state laws that govern how those matching grants can be used because presumably those beneficiaries from the 529 accounts still have not attended colleges or may be attending colleges in the future. One significant change from the language we heard earlier is that the matching grants may only be used for qualifying higher education expenses that were considered qualifying higher education purposes expenses at the federal level as of the date the program ended. So those matching grants would not be allowed to be used for any of the new qualifying higher education expenses that have been allowed under federal law since 2010. But other than that, most of these changes are just updating the state's laws that govern this the College Savings Plan program to account for these changes in federal law that I mentioned. And I'm happy to go through some of these sections or discuss the language in detail if members have questions.
All right. So if a member has a specific question that they would like clarification from Mr. Williams, then you may inform our committee administrator with that noted. And otherwise, we thank Mr. Williams. Ms. Miller, is there any specific questions for Mr. Williams at this time?
Madam Chair, there are no requests. There are three that would like to speak after the next testifier.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. We have a testifier who has requested to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Private College Council. And staff, will you please unmute Mr. Paul Cervanek? Line, and you may proceed.
Vice Chair Pryor, Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, I am Paul Cervanek, I am president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Before I proceed any farther, I just want to make sure everyone can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for this opportunity to testify on House File 3392. My remarks are going to be focused on the school closure provisions of this bill. but I want to begin by saying how much I appreciated the opportunity to talk at length with you, Chair Bernardi, about these issues. I also want to say that I and all of the Minnesota Private College Council institutions really appreciate the working group process that Commissioner Olson and the OHE staff initiated on these issues last fall. The working group process is a really important and deeply appreciated process by all stakeholders. MPCC and our 17 member institutions have been active participants in the working group meetings, which began last fall in response to the school closure concerns raised by the Argosy closure. We support the use of the working group process for issues like this because stakeholders can contribute important information and understanding that lead to the development of good and practical legislation. The working group process was on track in the fall, but came to a halt in December before any actual bill language was proposed and considered by the working group. In the absence of a release of bill language earlier in the session, MPCC and our members were surprised to see this bill on the committee agenda after the COVID pandemic hit. Over the past 2 weeks, MPCC and our member institutions have provided a written list of concerns and suggested language changes to OHE to address the issues our institutions have identified with the school closure portion of this bill. We have also shared those concerns and that language in writing with the House committee staff. I would like to briefly highlight them for you. They fall into three categories. First, the first issue is the amount of the surety bond required. This bill proposes a very significant increase in the surety bond. Current law provides a cap on the surety bond requirement of $250,000. Under the bill, for a typical MPCC institution, such as Augsburg or St. Kate's, the bond requirement would be in the range of $4 to $8 million. And for our largest institution, St. Thomas, the bond requirement would be $18 million. Our concern is that requiring such a large bond would be too costly, imposing unnecessary added financial stress on an institution when it might already be struggling. We are also concerned that if the bond amount is unreasonably large, it could be, as a practical matter, impossible for an institution to post the bond, leading the bond requirement itself to potentially force a closure when a closure may be otherwise unnecessary. The bill needs to strike a realistic and reasonable balance when it comes to the amount of the surety bond or the additional security required. I believe it's important for you all to know that our colleges, with their independent board governance structures and a sole mission of serving students, do not present the same risks that existed in the Argosy case. We do not have the financial conflicts that inherently exist in for-profit institutions between educational obligations to students and financial obligations to owners or shareholders. Nonprofit closures are more rare, and when nonprofits do close, they do so through an orderly winding down that protects the student interests that are everyone's concern, including the board of directors of nonprofit colleges. And because our colleges own physical assets in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars that would remain at the time of closure, there is little risk of financial loss. There is little risk of the financial loss that occurs in the Argosy type of situation if one of our colleges were ever to close. Our second concern is about the new risk analysis process provided for in the bill. We believe the language in the bill is not yet fully developed and ready for enactment. We don't oppose a risk analysis process. We just believe this legislation is not yet had the input that it needs to be ready for enactment. The actual financial measures that OHE will use under this analysis are not identified in the bill, and OHE did not specify them in the working group last fall. OHE has indicated it has a grant to undertake a process to identify specific measures of financial viability, and it intends to do that with the working group's involvement this summer. The bill should not advance until this work is done, whether that output is ultimately to be codified in statute or in rules or not codified at all. It should be understood and vetted before this bill is enacted. No economists or experts anywhere have designed an effective universal set of measures to accurately predict which institutions could be facing precipitous closure. The authority in the risk analysis provisions give OHE great power over very detailed and complex assessments of the financial health of an institution. It is deeply important to get the risk analysis measures and process defined and as well constructed as possible before a bill is passed. Third, our third concern is about the process protection for institutions in this legislation. There are many areas of the bill and the current statute where there could be improvements in the process that is contemplated either for the risk analysis or for the termination of participation in state financial aid programs or the termination of an institution's registration. Institutions have their very existence at stake in this legislation, and we believe the process should provide for fair and essential protection to set reasonable deadlines, allow for institutions to respond to OHE with additional information, time to correct violations or cure problems, and generally to ensure that there is a reasonable period of time for communication between OHE and any institution OHE is concerned about. We would appreciate the opportunity to ensure that all of those process protections are written in ways that work well for institutions as well as for the agency. Like OHE and all of you, MPCC wants this bill to be done right. We are concerned with the timelines we have been working under at this late stage in the legislative process. It is just not simply possible to get this bill done well in this circumstance. The fast timeline is particularly troubling at this time because CFOs at our institutions and other key staff who would be most knowledgeable about these issues and could provide the most expertise are consumed by the challenges of the current pandemic and not able to devote the time and attention this bill requires. We are also concerned that this bill is designed to address Argosy-type situations, but in the process of addressing those situations has imposed substantial, unreasonable, and costly burdens upon nonprofit institutions that do not present the same risk. For these reasons, MPCC cannot support the school closure provisions of this bill in their current form. We are optimistic that language can be found that meets OHE's purposes and that addresses concerns of our member institutions, but we are simply not there at this time. We would ask that the OHE working group process continue over the coming interim period so that these issues can be thoroughly addressed. If the school closure provisions of this bill do not advance in this session, we will, of course, remain committed to working on these issues with the agency and the committee staff over the summer and fall. Finally, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to share these concerns with the committee.
Vice Chair Pryor, I think you might be muted yourself.
There it is. Sorry, and I couldn't get my call back. thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sabdenik. Chair Bernardi, would you like one of your testifiers to address these issues?
Yes, I'd like to ask. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to have Office of Higher Education talk about the process in which they've engage stakeholders and how they have worked to come up with language that can work. And also the third thing is regarding the points that
the Mr. Cervenek made as far as things that still need to be worked on and how OHE has addressed those as the oversight agency.
All right, so staff.
Chair Pryor, this is Eric.
Yes, Eric.
Unmuted Commissioner Olson, Betsy Talbot, and Nikki Oliver, all from the Office of Higher Education, so I'll leave it up to them to decide who wants to speak.
All right. So as you come forward, please identify yourself.
Sure. This is Betsy Talbot from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I am the Manager of Institutional Registration and Licensing, and I'm the one who helped draft the language, and I'm also the one that's been holding working groups with representatives from our private colleges, including nonprofits and for-profits. So first, I'd like to address the process that we've been utilizing for stakeholder feedback in over the summer of 2019, our office issued an Argosy closure report as requested by the legislative branch. We utilized that report to initiate a legislative working group to start going over the report and thinking about and addressing the legislative holes that we discovered during the Argosy closure, but also the closures of other institutions. And so we started meeting in the fall. We did meet through November. Things did have to get canceled for December and January due to extenuating circumstances, and then we resumed again in February. And we also met twice in April and so far once in May. Our March did get canceled due to COVID-19 and trying to give space to institutions to respond appropriately. During that time, starting in December, the institution started seeing legislative language related to risk analysis and had been providing us feedback on that language all the way through yesterday, where we have been listening to institutions and incorporating thoughts and feedback on what is the risk to students and how do we balance the risks of students who are attending institutions that may or may not close. And then also, how do we protect students from those risks? So a lot of the thought is around this risk analysis. And Paul Cervenek from MPC is correct. No one in the nation knows how to use indicators of any variety, like a crystal ball, to evaluate institutions for risk for closure. What we can do is we can use things as red flags and for triggers for further analysis and questions and dialogues with institutions. And that is really the goal as we move forward with all of our institutions, private and nonprofit, especially in light of the current financial challenges that many of our institutions are facing, is that we are utilizing what information we have available to ensure that there are conversations between the state and the school to ensure that students are being adequately protected. And so there's never going to be a perfect process. There will never be perfect indicators. There will be no perfect magic wand crystal ball to evaluate the institutions. The only thing that we can do, again, is have a process that uses indicators to start a conversation and then do contingency planning and then sort of ladder different powers that the office can implement when it's necessary to protect consumers, which are those students who get harmed in a school closure situation, and the ability of these schools to remain open, to continue to carry out their mission to educate their students, and that opportunity to either be sold, to merge, or rebound from the financial crisis that they're facing. And we're always trying to balance those three needs of a school with those needs of a student. And the goal of this legislation is to find that sweet spot where, yes, there are increased powers, but the goal of those powers are not to lay them down to close an institution, but to allow those students to have some level of protection and communication without triggering that closure. So one of the things I'd also like to address was related to issues with surety requirements. We did get some recommendations from the prior session that the surety amounts were too low, and we did find that to be accurate. In a situation where an institution has 1,000 students, charges $500 per credit, and the average student takes 9 credits per semester, and there's 2.5 semesters per year, that $250,000 does not go very far and would not even reach beyond priority 1 or 2 of the use of that funding. And when we look at these institutions and that cap, we do need to come up with a better insurance amount to cover risks to students. Surety amounts act very similar to your car insurance. There's times where you're going to get into an accident with someone who drives a 1998 Honda Civic. And then there's also going to be times where you're going to have an accident with someone where they're driving a Lamborghini. We want to ensure that we're not always insuring for the Lamborghini situations, but we can't also always just provide insurance for the levels of the 1998 Honda Civic. We have to find a better value for that kind of insurance for students, because again, we want schools to be able to continue providing their education. We don't want to close them down, but we want to give them that allowance to stay open, but still ensure that we're providing some basic level of insurances for those students. And so that's where we're trying to come up with a better way of calculating what that surety amount is going to be. I think one of the key things about a bond or if this insurance is its costs are very variable. You're going to have, just like your car insurance, you're going to have institutions who have very good credit ratings, are very low risk of closure by their insurance companies, and are not going to charge very much for the insurance. As insurance goes up, because the risks go up. So you'll see institutions who have a higher risk, therefore, their insurance premiums are going to be higher. But what's different about car insurance versus this insurance is that we're not intending to ever require this of all schools. This is only for schools who are actually at risk of closing. So most of our institutions are not going to see this surety requirement applied to them. It's only going to be in those situations where we've identified risk, communicated that risk with the school, allowed the school to respond and refute that risk, and we still find there to be a very high risk to students that needs to be insured. So again, we recognize there is an increased cost of the surety requirement, but we also want to ensure that that bond is only being triggered at appropriate times and that many institutions would not be required to hold that form of insurance. I'm trying to think of, Bernardi, you had 3 items that you would like me to discuss, and I'm trying to remember if I got all of them in that.
Chair Bernardi.
Thank you. I was wondering, maybe we can go back to those specific questions, but if we could have Commissioner Olson give an overview about the importance of this bill and why is it so important to pass it now, and his perspective on this bill, that would be helpful. And then maybe we can follow up with questions after.
All right, Commissioner Olson, you should now be unmuted.
Thank you, Vice Chair Pryor and Representative Bernardi, and thank you to the members of the committee for the opportunity to offer some insight on behalf of the Office of Higher Education here. Everything that Ms. Talbot shared is a process that we all agree has not been ideal, but also agree has been extensive to the best opportunity possible. And you know, I just want to remind the committee of our role as a state agency. We've discussed in previous committee hearings about the existing higher education accountability system being comprised of state oversight, as well as oversight of accrediting agencies, as well as the U.S. Department of Education. And this is coined in higher education as the regulatory triad, and states are really responsible for authorizing institutions to operate as well as providing consumer protections to students. The role of the accrediting agencies in the triad are essentially charged with assuring the quality of institutions, and the U.S. Department of Education certifies the eligibility for federal financial aid through Title IV. The really, you know, the state's role in the triad is foundational because institutions must first obtain a state authorization prior to seeking accreditation of or any federal aid eligibility. And I will just reiterate, too, the reason for this is, you know, really a response to the legislature's request to develop a process that of course centers students and balances them with the needs of institutions during times of potential financial concern or crisis. And, you know, throughout history in Minnesota, we've really experienced multiple abrupt closures, but, you know, we now need to position our agency now more than ever to be able to appropriately respond to ensure that if an institution is showing signs of a potential closure or financial difficulty, that we as the responsible state agency and regulatory authority of the triad are there to facilitate and provide assistance to help right the ship if possible, but also to be there to provide a pathway for potential orderly wind down, one that provides adequate teach out arrangements for students to be able to complete, but also protects their financial aid and, of course, protects the state resources that are appropriated to be able to award financial aid to students. You know, we absolutely want the story of Augusta University to be the last precipitous abrupt closure that we experienced in Minnesota, and positioning through this bill the agency's ability to assist institutions while at the same time putting adequate protections in place for students, we feel really answers that call. And I do really appreciate the testimony of Mr. Cirkvenik from the Minnesota Private Colleges Council. We have worked as closely as we possibly can, and again, definitely want to recognize that the process has not been perfect, but I'd like to, you know, let the committee know how much I value strong community and stakeholder input in everything we do. We think it makes it a better process. We think it makes bills cleaner and workable for everybody. You know, we also recognize that the process has been interrupted, really because everybody's going through the unfortunate COVID-19 pandemic right now. But, you know, really states must take a leading role during this unparalleled time of financial uncertainty, you know, brought on to higher education by COVID-19. This is our opportunity now more than ever to proactively align systems and, you know, really empower the agency to take necessary steps to protect students that are caught up in potential institutional financial difficulties or, you know, potentially even closures. This is really our responsibility and our role, you know, one that's not discussed that often, but one is absolutely necessary to uphold our ability to ensure that students are protected. You know, and I will just off the cuff respond to the comment about private institutions holding, you know, significant assets. That is absolutely true, and, you know, we do know that there are plenty of differences to draw from private for-profit institutions and private nonprofit institutions in the state. We know we have an incredible higher ed sector in Minnesota, from public institutions to private nonprofits, private for-profits, and, you know, students that are represented in each sector. You know, but we also know that we can't rely solely on assets and do need some sort of insurance for students. You know, we've seen the sale of assets, unfortunately, like was the case of Argus University, be tied up in federal court-appointed receivership or bankruptcy proceedings, and that unfortunately doesn't help students now
who rely on financial aid funds in their pockets immediately. And, you know, we saw that loud and clear with Argosy. And so there are ways here to balance, you know, the needs of institutions, but also make sure that students have what they need each and every day, but also if they're experiencing potential financial difficulties or even leading into closure. And with that, Madam Chair, certainly stand ready for any additional questions, but really appreciate the time and consideration from the members of the committee today.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Staff, Ms. Miller, do we have, I guess we'll go to members' question now, and as I remember, it was Representative Nornes with the first question then, now that we finished the testimony. Representative Nornes, you are now unmuted.
Members of the committee, I would rather wait until the other members of the committee have had a chance to ask their questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dornis. I think next on our list was Representative Runbeck. And if staff would please unmute Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. First of all, I wanted to thank Mr. Cirkvenic for a very lucid description of where the concerns are with this bill, which I believe is really true, especially since there's not been a kind of a sign-off, let's just say, from that group of schools. But so a lot of questions since his speaking, but I'm concerned. I mean, I went to one of those schools, and they haven't always had the most perfect financial status, I'm sure. But they have tremendous backers and supporters. You know, they're different than a for-profit school. But I'm wondering, for example, does the power in this bill that's going to OHE, does it allow them to, like, publicly announce a particular school's individual financial status? Maybe it's a little shaky. I mean, you know, what things is OHE prohibited from doing? Because now they have tremendous power to make that school succeed or fail even more. So I'd like to know that. I'm concerned about this whole area of student complaints. It's very undefined. And, I mean, what's a material complaint? You know, that the meals aren't good enough or, you know, too many, whatever, you know what I mean? It's, how can any complaint be a valid and actionable complaint? That only invites a lot of things that are probably frivolous. So I have a question there. I'll end it there in terms of those two things right now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Runbeck. I think Ms. Talbot, maybe we can start with you.
Sure. This is Elizabeth Talbot again, Betsy Talbot from the Office of Higher Education. And I apologize, I'm trying to catch up with the powers because I wanted to be very specific. So, no, first of all, we would not, we're not proposing and we're not recommending a change to the non-public status of financial information. Financial information under 136A.64 is already declared as non-public. And it can't be given out unless we're using it as a basis of, like, a Chapter 14 administrative hearing. And the intent is to not change that because we want to make sure that there's no run on the bank. We want to make sure that we're not triggering a closure because we're giving out information that will not be accurate or be misused. Or, again, forces a school to go into closure mode because students are now fleeing, when really there are good opportunities for the institution to remain open, get supporters, things like that, increase their liquidity, whatever it may be. So, no, we're not recommending a change on financial indicators. There is a component where we ask for the ability to start notifying students and start communicating with students, and that would be used in situations where the school has already announced their closure
or things are happening that they need information on, like our office has student transcripts, so the registrar's office can't fulfill them any longer, and therefore our office is doing it, or this is what's happening with your federal financial aid. You know, in situations like the Minnesota School of Business and Globe University closure, it would have been helpful for them, because this is a very detailed reason, but the U.S. Department of Education required a communication be sent to students, but it wasn't clear it was from them versus us, and those students really could have used a mass communication from us to provide that clarification, because the school didn't want to provide it, and then the department didn't require it. So those are situations where you want to communicate with students directly in a way to respond to issues. But the powers in general that we're seeking to do are things that are supposed to ladder up to protect students. So that may be we want copies of all transcripts, just to have them on hand in case you closed abruptly and you're not able to get them to us at the last minute. We also want to be able to, if we find it's necessary, to get money back from state financial aid, so that you don't misappropriate those funds, then that would happen, or we would start making payments directly to students. We really don't want to have to do another Argosy bill like we had to do last spring, where we needed emergency powers to pay students directly. We sometimes, instead of having us pay the student, sometimes we go over with the money to the school and watch them apply it to the student's account and then issue those refund checks to students. Those are types of actions that we would seek to do. We would also seek to trigger a surety requirement if one is not currently in place, because the one trigger right now is based on a federal requirement, which is very behind schedule and sometimes. Like, we've seen a school get delisted by the SEC very quickly. Their financials fell within probably 9 months to a year, but that financial score was about 18 months behind schedule. So when they did end up closing in Minnesota, we had no surety with them because we didn't have a trigger for it, even though we really needed to have one in place once we started getting those reports that are, it's public information from the SEC. So those are examples of the powers where we would want to see some changes in what's happening. We also want to make sure that we can require monitoring on like a quarterly basis or a monthly basis. Liquidity is frequently a problem with institutions. So we want to make sure that we can get that liquidity information down to the month, and so we know when payroll is not going to be able to be paid any longer. I think those are the main powers that we're seeking to do. So that's kind of a good summary of it. And then student complaints. I think the student complaint language is already there. So we already have the authority to review student complaints. We do receive them from many types of institutions. We do have a variety of sources of them, and some are stronger complaints than others. And I don't know if the question is referring to the fee that we proposed or how the student complaint information can be used.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Rumbeck, further follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would think there might be a process that some are culled out because they are not material. You know, it is not anything other than a frivolous complaint. And what are you going to do about the food service? I mean, really, things like that. Unless you consider everything material, and that would be very frightening. I would say that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Rumbeck. Ms. Miller, do we have further member questions, knowing that we're saving Representative Nornes?
Madam Chair, members, we also have Representative Daniels and Representative Cleavorn.
All right. Representative Daniels, the staff will unmute you. and proceed with your question.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. I've got kind of a number of issues, and I don't want to spend a lot of time harping on it, but the testimony we had today from Mr. Cervenic was pretty eye-opening to me, that kind of confirmed me when I was reading through the bill that we may overstep the boundaries of what we want to accomplish in this bill. So without going through all the details, you know, everything from the bonding to the penalties to all that type of things that the college could be liable for, could I make a motion to lay the bill on the table until we get more time to get agreement on it? And also, I was looking at the Senate bill, and they don't look too much the same. So maybe we need to have some Senate and House meetings to kind of get that language a little bit more similar. Would that be a possibility, Chair Pryor?
Well, I think that this is our last committee meeting, so the feasibility of further discussion using our committee time is not going to be a possibility. So, you know, this bill is still part of the process. It's going now to Ways and Means, and there still is, as you said, the different Senate version. So there's, it's still in the process. And I think, are you making that motion right now?
Well, I think that
and
would be the best.
And asking us to consider it?
Yeah, Vice Chair Pryor, when you get a chance, I could help answer the question as well.
Yeah, I will give it then to Chair Bernardi for that.
Thank you for that question. And we are in talks with the Senate right now and working on any language improvements. We are close to the end of session. We needed to hear this bill today to be able to meet deadlines. And the Senate is going to be hearing theirs on Thursday, so there will be opportunities to make additional changes. And so this is part of the process in which to move this bill forward to be able to come up with a bill that helps protect our students and helps our institutions as well. So that's how this process is playing out at the end of session, and I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi.
I appreciate that, Chair Bernardi. Thank you. I just don't think the bill is ready in its current form. So I'd like to make a motion to lay it on the table. I'd like to request a roll call.
Right, the motion before us is to lay the bill on the table, and we will unmute members. We'll unmute members for the roll call vote. And you may proceed, Mr. Peterson.
Chair Bernardi?
No.
Vice Chair Pryor?
No.
Representative Nornes?
Yes.
Representative Daniels?
Yes.
Representative Franson? Representative Franson?
Yes, sorry, I had you on mute too.
Representative Gomez?
No.
Representative Cleavorn?
No.
Representative Lehman?
Yes.
Representative Lean?
No.
Representative Lilly?
No.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
No.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Runbeck?
Representative Runbeck is locked out. I'm just going to let her in back real quick.
I'm going to proceed. We'll Representative Vang?
No.
Representative Wolgamott?
No.
Representative Zhang?
No.
Representative Runbeck, are you back?
There you go, try it now.
Representative Runbeck?
Are we voting on a layover?
The motion to layover? Yes. Correct.
Okay,
that's
yes.
Correct motion.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Chair Pryor, there are 7 ayes and 10 nays.
With 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not carry. We will continue with discussion. And I believe we had Representative Cleborne had the next question. Staff will unmute Representative Cleborne, and please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and thank you, Chair Bernardi, for bringing the bill forward. I just want to start off with 2 things. First, I want to say thank you for everyone who spent the time and effort to put this compromise bill together. I realize the amount of work that has gone into it, so I want to say thank you. The second thing is I want to say that I believe every member of this committee wants to have a robust higher education committee in Minnesota. And so that's a compliment of both public and private nonprofit institutions, and even in some cases private for-profit institutions where a need may be unmet in the others. I would like to just go back to when Ms. Talbot was giving her testimony initially. She just kept talking about student protections under the consumer protection language of the bill, but I also want to remind the committee that these are also taxpayer protections. We need to make sure that when our Office of Higher Education is charged with this triad role that was explained by Commissioner Olson, that we keep front and center that it is the taxpayers and the students who would bear the cost of closure. And we all know that in receivership or bankruptcy, you do not get dollar for dollar. So I would be very concerned if we just said that we were going to have surety bonds that were incredibly low and out of date with today's current cost of higher education. I just wanted to bring that. But also, too, I would like to ask either the commissioner or Ms. Talbot to address the issue. We, and I won't name the school, but we have a school in Minnesota, which is one of our private colleges, that has a sister institution that has gone into closure in another state. Would this bill protect our states from when we start seeing those risks in other states? Would the Office of Higher Education be stepping in and looking at that institution, at their solvency? If you could address that, I would appreciate it.
Commissioner Olson. And staff could unmute Commissioner Olson. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Cleborne, thank you for the question. And my apologies, without knowing the institution, nor would I request that you disclose that here. Yes, we would have information that's part of the information that we would receive from the U.S. Department of Education, and would be required to respond at the state level for those institutions that would be in Minnesota as well as in other states. Ms. Talbot may want to weigh in more on that if she's aware of the actual institution name or scenario.
And I will say, too, that we're looking at the clock right now, And we know that we do have some more questions. So, if, Representative Claiborne, does that answer your question, suffice?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure that we understand that there is no institution which could not come upon hard times. And when we see these private institutions also in other states where we know they operate in our state, I just want to make sure that this bill would afford our state the opportunity then to look into that sister institution which is in our state. Thank you. I'm finished. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Miller, I know that we still have Representative Nornes. Are we ready to go to Representative Nornes for his question?
Madam Chair, we also have Representative Quam and Representative Poppy.
All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit perplexed and confused because in all the other committees, when we hit the change in how we're running meetings and et cetera, there was a small group effort on the different topics that allowed for the four caucuses to come to some consensus before bills were moved forward. And my understanding is the change in fees and some of the language that was instituted with the amended language, that this bill is sufficiently different from the one that was heard in committee in the past. And consulting people, it did not seem as if it went through that agreed-upon process, and that is a large reason, I think, why many of us felt this wasn't appropriate to do today. So I'm just, I wish we had Zoom meeting instead of just a call-in number and had a more thorough discussion, because there are issues with this that I'm not settled with, but thank you.
Chair Bernardi, would you like to address the comment?
Thank you, Vice Chair Pryor. We, that provision had changed in the a little while ago, and we are working to get bipartisan support this week with the Senate. And we are in those discussions. Obviously, we want to get bipartisan support all around. It has been worked on bipartisanly. The schedule that's in front of us required us to move forward with our committee hearing today, continue our discussions, and take into account, you know, stakeholders' input as well. And a number of things have been addressed, and there's still three remaining issues. Most of the language is in this bill has been supported, and I think the one provision that you're referring to, the fees actually went down to address the concerns of stakeholders. So anyway, want to let you know that we're working towards bipartisan support. This is one step in the process. And we will continue to work trying to gain that and get this through this year, because this is super important to get these protections for our students and for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Poppy, your question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment. I do appreciate that we're trying to find a balance between the student needs and what they should be achieving and the school and what they're bringing forward, especially in light of the fact that we have many private colleges that have a great long history with us here in Minnesota, and as well as our public schools. So I think it's important to recognize we do have a lot of opportunities for higher education throughout the state, and that's a good thing. Our students deserve to have lots of choices, and they do. And I do think that Mr. Zuckbenig raised some good points about what still might be necessary to accomplish for the private colleges and universities to be on board with what this bill is going to be looking like in the final stage. But I think the motion is to move the bill forward and to hopefully have you continue to have your discussions, Chair Bernardi, to make sure that those concerns that he raised can continue to be addressed. And I wish you luck to be able to get to that point. So today I'll vote in support of moving it forward, but I do acknowledge that I believe the private colleges have some concerns, and I think they're, you know, maybe biting off a little more than we're ready to at this point. So I just want to raise that, I guess, and thank you for the work that you've done, and good luck as you move into the final stage.
Thank you, Representative Poppe. Chair Bernardi, a response to the comment from Representative Poppe.
I think she stated that very well, and thank you for her comment.
Ms. Miller, any more member questions?
Madam Chair, we just have Representative Nornes and then Representative Bernardi.
All right, Representative Nornes.
Thank you very much, and I'll be very, very brief here. Number one, after hearing the testimony and going through the bill, again, I've got a lot of troubles or questions. So at this point, I'm not going to be able to support the bill. I do have some concerns. If this were to pass as it is, my question of the agency, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, is, will this require some additional staff? It seems like we're putting a lot of extra work on the agency, and nobody's talked about that, so it's increasing some cost to accomplish this.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nornes. There is a related fiscal note to the bill, but you will see essentially with the increase in fees, there will be additional support to the Licensing and Registration Division, which could potentially support additional staff and support the additional work required, but is essentially treated as budget neutral with the increase in fees and the expenditures related directly related to the fees.
Okay, thank you. I guess in closing, I'm very concerned about the overall financial cloud that's hanging over all of our higher institutions in the state, including everyone that we currently have, and I guess it's going to be a tough year going forward, and I don't know that this particular bill is going to make it any easier, at least for some of them. So at this point, I will not be able to vote for yes on the way out. Hope it improves when it eventually comes back.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Chair Bernardi, any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Pryor. I want to thank our members for the very thoughtful conversation today and for our testifiers. I appreciate all the thought and time and sincere commitment to get a bill that works and that helps protect our students and our taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. This COVID-19 has even highlighted more the importance that we have these measures in place so that we are able to intervene early, help support our institutions, and help support our students so that we can correct whatever we can. So instead of having going to the nth hour and having a school close abruptly. So I want to thank everyone for their thoughtfulness and for the bipartisan support we've had, and we're moving this forward in the spirit of intent of gaining that by the end of session, and want to let you know that we will continue to work with stakeholders, and before the Senate comes up today, we're going to have further conversations with the Senate before their hearing on Thursday is the plan. And just really want to thank you, and I look forward to doing whatever we can this session to be able to help protect our students and help our institutions and the state of Minnesota. So with that, I would like to renew my motion to refer House File
3392 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Chair Bernardi renews her motion to refer House File 3392 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Staff will unmute the lines, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Bernardi?
Aye.
Chair Bernardi votes aye. Vice Chair Pryor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pryor votes aye. Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Nornes votes no. Representative Daniels?
Daniels votes no.
Representative Daniels votes no. Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Franson votes no. Representative Gomez?
Aye.
Representative Gomez votes aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Lehman?
No.
Representative Lehman votes no. Representative Lean?
Aye.
Representative Lean votes aye. Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Lilly votes aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero votes no. Representative Poppy?
Aye.
Representative Poppy votes aye. Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Quam votes no. Representative Runbeck?
No.
Representative Runbeck votes no. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang votes aye. Representative Volgamont?
Aye.
Representative Volgamont votes aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang votes aye. Chair Pryor, there are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion carries, and House File 3392, as amended, is on its way to Ways and Means. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.